Everybody, this is the first lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women, hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg, in collaboration with the Dharma Drum Institute of Liberal Art in Taiwan. And before I get into my actual topic today, the karma of female rebirth, I just wanted to have an overview of the entire course and also of what we have been doing in the past. Of course, this is the third and also the last course on this whole topic of women in Buddhism, gender. So the topics that we will be covering this year, the first three are of a somewhat general nature. I'm getting us started with the question of the karma of female birth, the question of whether it is or at what point in the tradition it can be considered that to be born as a woman is the effect of that karma. Then the next lecture will be on mother and motherhood and the following on children, two of course obvious and important aspects of the role of women. From these three introductory lectures, we then proceed region-wise. First, we will have three lectures in the Theravada setting on Thailand, Myanmar, and Sri Lanka. And since we have covered Theravada countries already in quite some detail in the first of our courses, we are having only one lecture for each of these countries. But then we move on to Japan. We have two lectures on Japan, two lectures on China, and two lectures on Tibet. And finally, we have a concluding lecture on women's soteriological agency, which concludes the course and also this whole series of three courses. The present course, in a way, builds on the two previous courses. In 2014, we started with a focus on one particular topic that is quite controversial and much discussed, the question of bhikkhuni ordination, its importance, its legal aspects. And from this one specific topic or problem, we broadened out to take a wider look at women in Indian Buddhism. And with this course, we take the still broader perspective. We move from Indian Buddhism to the whole of Asian Buddhism. And the whole idea of these three courses is to interrelate, exchange information, and make accessible to a wide range of students. I think this year we have over 400 registrations for this course. The findings of different scholars working in this general field of Buddhist studies and specializing on women and gender issues. And as part of this information exchange, if I may so call it, I also wanted to announce some recent publications. One is by myself. I've just come out, and it's just come out a few days ago, with a book on the foundation of the foundation history of the Nuns Order. This is quite a thick one this time. It's a detailed study based on the translation of all the extant canonical versions of how the Order of Nuns was actually founded, and an attempt to understand how different elements in this story have come into being. Then there is a movie by Martin Seeger, who was part of our 2014 course also. He has been able to show that a text that was traditionally attributed to a very famous monk was instead written by a female author. For our 2015 course, there is a book by Alice Collette that has just come out. In fact, I was hoping to be able to show you a copy, but unfortunately it has not yet arrived here. So she studies lives of early Buddhist nuns, biographies as history. And there's another something I also wanted to say in relation to another lecturer of that 2015 course, and that is Rita Gross. Rita Gross was actually working on a book, How Clinging to Gender Obstructs Enlightenment, and unfortunately she passed away on the 11th of November. And those of you who have been with us last year might still remember that actually she gave a lecture almost like lying in bed. She was already at that time in a very sick condition. And I'm very sorry because I was really looking forward to this book. I had met Rita some time ago in the US, and from then on we had regular contacts, and she would sometimes send me her papers and I would send her my papers. We would comment on each other's writings. And I was really looking forward to her showing how this whole clinging to gender obstructs enlightenment, or I prefer obstructs awakening. And so I would like to dedicate this lecture that I'm giving today to Rita Gross in recognition of my personal friendship and also of the work that she has been done in the area of research on women in Buddhism. I'm pretty sure she would have enjoyed this lecture. Okay, now I'm ready to get into my actual topic. I begin with an inscription from Thailand, which in a way shows us an attitude towards the female body. This is the queen mother from the royal family, and she's just founded a whole monastery. And as is usual in traditional Buddhist cultures, when you make a major offering, you dedicate the merit for something that you aspire to. So the dedication of merit she makes is, by the power of my merit, may I be reborn as a male in the future. May I retain this woman's accumulated merit. So the point I am intending to make by quoting this inscription is not only this wish to this idea that the merit acquired, I want to use that to become a male, but actually the wish is so strong that at the time of formulating this wish, she already looks back on her actually present existence of that woman, this woman. She's so much, her mind is so much aspiring to be a male that she's already identifying with that future role. And this has already been pointed out by the editors of the inscription. So they say, this woman is of course the donor herself in her present existence. She's here speaking as if she had already been reborn as a male and were viewing the present events in retrospect. And this inscription is symptomatic for a prevalent attitude even in modern day Thailand, where the fact that one is born as a woman is seen as in somewhat in a negative light, and it is generally considered that it would have been much better to be reborn as a male. This has been studied by, for example, Chatsuman Kabir Singh, now Bhikkhuni Dhammananda. And so if we now want to understand where does this idea come from? What makes for this notion that it's good karma to be born a male and bad karma to be born a female? Of course, we need to go back in time and slowly see what we can find in the different historical strata of Buddhist literature that in some way or another relates to this notion. So as we go back, we come to the commentaries, and there's this one passage where one woman expresses why she would rather be a male. And so she says it's disgusting to be a woman. Even the daughter of a chakravarti is under the control of others. Therefore, I do not want to be a woman. I want to be a man. Chakravarti is... In the early scriptures, it's a somewhat symbolic, even humorous motive. It is this idea that somebody who has highly developed qualities that one could even become a Buddha, instead of going forth, could become a universal monarch, ruler over the whole world, described in somewhat exaggerated and even sometimes hilarious terms as being endowed with supernatural gems, they are called. He has a most beautiful wife and a counselor, a general, some magic animals and rules. And this Chakravarti is as somebody who rules over the entire world and ensures that everything is in peace and according to Dharma. And whereas in the early Buddhist period, this seems to have been, at least this is what I've argued in one of my publications, this seems to have been somewhat humorous, a little bit like making fun of ancient Indian notions of rulership. In the course of time, it became quite real, and it could even inform political ideas in Buddhist countries. But what for our present purposes is relevant is simply that this is the princess of the universal monarch. So this is about the highest position we could imagine for a woman within the ancient Indian social political sphere. But even then, she's under control of others. What is interesting about this passage is that it kind of alerts us to the idea that this negative appraisal of being a woman and this wish to become a man is in some way related to the fact that women are discriminated in their respective societies, that as a woman one simply has lesser options and is always placed in a position of dependency. And this was particularly strong in ancient India, and we can see that already reflected in texts that come around the Buddhist time, but much stronger even later, where a woman is in principle in a dependent situation and is being under the power / protection of her father, husband or son. So then we come to another commentary. This is a commentary on the Dhammapada, and it explains what type of karma leads to male birth in the future and what type of karma leads to female birth. So we are told men who have transgressed with the wives of others will after death be tormented for many hundreds of thousands of years in hell. On coming back to human existence, they will for 100 rebirths undergo birth as a woman. It's very clear this is an unwholesome deed that has been done, and the retribution is that first of all one goes to hell for a long time, and the retribution has not yet been exhausted by that, but after that one will be reborn as a woman. So it's very obvious that this relates the fact that one is born as a woman to a bad karma done in the past. And here we get the converse. Women who have made marriage by giving, etc., and have discarded the wish for birth as a woman with the mental resolve, may this merit of ours lead to the obtaining of rebirth as a man, will after death obtain rebirth as a man. So I think this is very clear, shows us the root for the inscription that we have been looking at above. It is precisely this idea, merit by giving. The Queen Mother has donated a whole monastery, and she does not want to be a woman. She has that mental resolve to be a man. In fact, we saw that mental resolve is so strong that she already now identifies with being a male. And so she makes this aspiration with the wish to become reborn as a male. Now, besides the question of rebirth, there's also another and somewhat, maybe to our Western eyes, peculiar phenomena in Buddhist and wider Indian literature, the idea of change of sex in the same life. This is not talking about what happens after rebirth, but much rather the idea is that somebody in particular circumstances could just completely change sex. Like, imagine I'm sitting here and suddenly, shoom, I become a woman, and becoming a woman not only in the way how I act, but actually having actual breasts and even reproductive organs of a female. And the same can also happen in the opposite direction, according to ancient Indian thought. Now, for our present purposes, it is not so much relevant what we think of this in realistic terms, whether we think it at all possible or not, that something like this could happen, but the point is only to look at it at what does it tell us about the evolution of gender, about the values given to these type of changes. And so Wendy Doninger has this to say in general on India. She says, where men are usually cursed to become women, women often choose to be men. A not surprising asymmetry, since the culture regards male status as higher than female. This again reflects the pattern that this change, so for me to change from male to female would be, I would be cursed, or I would have done something very bad in the past. And if I were sitting here as a bhikkhuni and I would suddenly turn into man, then this would something agreeable and wished by me. And this simply reflects the fact that in the ancient Indian setting in particular, men are very clearly in an advantageous position over women. Now, the commentary on the Pali Vinaya discusses one such case where there is actual gender change. And so it explains that, staying with the example of our analogy, if I were to change into a bhikkhuni now, into a female, then the fact that I'm losing my male characteristics is because of a strong unwholesome deed committed by me. But the replacement by female characteristics, my acquiring of female marks, is due to a weak wholesome deed. We see here there is a very clear evaluation. And conversely, if some of the bhikkhunis attending this lecture would now change suddenly into a male, I hope they don't have that misfortune, but let us just take this example, then that the fact that they lose their female marks or characteristic is due to a weak unwholesome deed, and the replacement by a male characteristic is due to a strong wholesome deed. So we see here again in the commentary level of Pali literature a clear evaluation. Overall, it is, although it is a wholesome deed that leads to the acquiring of the gender characteristics of the other sex, the fact that the loss of male is a strong unwholesome deed and loss of female a weak unwholesome deed clearly shows that there is an evaluation involved here. But when we come to the Pali Vinaya, it's very interesting. We do not find any evaluation. So there's this case, somebody suddenly changes gender, let us stay with the example Analaya suddenly become a bhikkhuni. Then the way the Buddha is portrayed in the Pali Vinaya, he just reacts to it with matter of fact. He says, well, go to stay with the bhikkhunis. Don't stay with the bhikkhus. But there is no explicit indication anyway that it is like a bad karma for me to change into a bhikkhuni and a good karma for a bhikkhuni to change into a bhikkhu. Both types of changes are just dealt with as a matter of fact. Apparently this kind of things happened or were imagined to happen in ancient India, and this is what should be done when it happens. So we see here that the evaluation found at the commentary level is not found at the canonical and historically earlier level. And this is, I think, already quite an important indication for the arising of this type of notion in Pali literature of the Theravada tradition. And the interesting thing is we get the same difference when we turn to the Sarvasivada Mula Sarvastivada tradition. There's a work, the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya, which we could maybe roughly loosely compare to the importance of the Visuddhimagga in the Theravada tradition. And it also takes up this issue of change of sex. And it says that when a monk changes into a female, it actually gives a very specific karmic deed that leads to that. And it's an unwholesome deed. It is because this monk has called other monks females. Very offensive. But when we go to the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya itself, there's, this has also been pointed out by Damchur Finnegan, there is no explicit evaluation of change of sex. It's just dealt with matter of fact. So it seems, excuse me for a moment. So it seems that we have a pattern here. We have a pattern where the earlier strata of literature, the canonical literature in the Vinayas, deals with this idea of sex of change in a matter-of-fact way without an evaluation. And it is only with later exegetical texts that such an evaluation is brought in. That the idea that it is bad karma to be a woman is apparently a later development can also be seen if we look at the general topic of karma, very recurrent topic in the early suttas, and there is one discourse that gives a very detailed examination of karma. That's the Chulakama Vibhanga Sutta, excuse me. When I did my comparative study of Majjhima Nikaya discourses, I was struck that this discourse has just so many parallels in so many different languages. It's so far of all the discourses I've come across in the whole of the four Pali Nikayas, it's the discourse with most versions in most different languages. And of course, the number of parallels and number of languages is somewhat due to the vicissitude of transmission, but I still think it clearly speaks for the interest that the topic of karma has aroused in the Buddhist traditions. And so this Chulakama Vibhanga Sutta and its parallels, they give very straightforward kind of relationships. So we have killing others. So if I kill others, then in future I will become short-lived. I mean, this is quite obvious, even if one were to reject the whole idea of rebirth, even talking about it within one's present life. I mean, if somebody is involved in killings, the chances that he or she will sooner or later be killed themselves is quite high. Similarly, hurting others, one will become sick. Somebody who is prone to get into fights with others, the chances that he or she will also be hurt is fairly great. But of course, in this discourse, the question is predominantly about rebirth. Then being angry, will become ugly. This is also fairly obvious. Somebody who has an angry face doesn't look particularly beautiful. Being envious, one will become uninfluential. Being stingy, one will become poor. Being arrogant, one will be of low birth. Not asking questions, one will become stupid. So Ravichandra Kumar says that karma was a common term in ancient India, parallel term in many religion teachings. Yeah, karma is a general concept in the ancient Indian context, but it seems to me that the emphasis on volition in particular is a significant Buddhist contribution to this notion of karma. And what we get here, what I wanted to point out in taking up this discourse, is that it gives us a whole list or survey of what actions lead to what kind of unwelcome or detrimental results. It does not mention becoming a woman at all. So it seems that at the time when this discourse and its various parallels came into existence, that the question like what kind of karma leads to rebirth as a male contrast to a female was not at all central. It was simply not being considered. And I think the only place where in this scheme we could put in the question of being reborn as a woman would be under this item, being envious, one will become uninfluential. Because in ancient Indian society, women were not influential. They had much less influence than males. So Ravichandra Kumar asks, how much of this is influenced by Brahmanism and Jainism? Well, I mean, the Buddhist teachings obviously have the ancient Indian cultural, philosophical, and social background as their starting point. So it must definitely be influenced by these notions, but according to the account of the Buddha's awakening, which we find in a number of sutras, such as, for example, Bhayabhairava Sutta and its Ekotarika Agama parallel. The Buddha, before in his quest for awakening, he first followed existing ancient Indian approaches to awakening, if I may so call them, by first studying deep absorption under Dalara Kulama and Uddakaramaputta, and then engaging in ascetic practices. And then he found his own approach to awakening, and in the night of his Bodhi, he is reportedly realized what is called the Trividya, the three higher knowledges. And the third of these higher knowledges is his actual awakening, but the other two, which apparently precede and I would argue stand in some logical relationship to his awakening, are the recollection of his own past lives and what is called the divine eye, the ability to see the passing away and being reborn of other beings according to their deeds. This makes the teaching on karma in relation to rebirth an essential component of the Buddha's own awakening. And so from speaking from within the viewpoint of tradition, I think we have to, one would consider the teaching on karma to be the outcome of the Buddha's own realization and also the belief in rebirth. So definitely the idea itself was already around in ancient India, but from a Buddhist tradition one would have to consider this as intentionally taken over, accepted by the Buddha, and even verified in his own experience. Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, in early Buddhist texts, the Buddha is portrayed to clearly intentionally reject beliefs that were common in ancient India but not considered in accordance with the Buddha's own teachings. He would have been able to reject the belief in karma and not to be influenced by it. The Buddha seems shown to be capable of ideological and philosophical critique. Thus, the idea of infant seems a bit weak. Yeah, I understand your point, but I still think, I mean, influence is fine because the Buddha did not operate within a vacuum. It's not that he was not influenced by the beliefs that are around him. And I think this is particularly important, if I may stir it, the discussion back to our main topic of gender, also for some degree of endorsement of a hierarchy of gender, as we find it clearly enshrined in the Vinayas. So I think I wouldn't... I feel comfortable with the idea of using the term influence, but then seeing, as you clearly and definitely state, that this influence is not a blind taking over of existent notions and ideas, but much rather, according to tradition, a testing out and verification of these. And so there are things, I mean, I'm really getting away from my main topic, but just briefly, for example, the central teaching on the Four Noble Truths is a very distinct Buddhist formulation of the approach to awakening, but it still is influenced, if I may use that term, by an ancient Indian scheme of medical diagnosis. Just one other example. So I think it is fine, as Ravi Chandra Kumar said, that there is an influence by the ancient Indian environment. It is clearly represented, rebirth, karma and rebirth are clearly represented as distinct Buddhist discoveries of the Buddha, and they're also very integral elements in the Buddhist teaching. I mean, even right view and wrong view is being defined as the wrong view is the negation of rebirth, and the scheme of the four levels of awakening is formulated in terms of when they are going to be reborn. So that the attempt sometimes found in modern Western Protestant Buddhist circles to deny the rebirth aspect of the early Buddhist teachings in order to cater to modern day notions that the whole of the mind is the product of the brain, and I think this is not convincing. I mean, people can be free to accept or reject rebirth, but as long as we're talking about early Buddhist doctrine and sincerely try to understand it instead of using it to construct or our own ideas, we have to accept and see that karma and rebirth are integral aspects of the early Buddhist teaching and doctrine. Bhikkhu Nilamadina says that she agrees and that her point was with regard to soteriological notions he would or would not accept yet. Yes. Thank you. So coming back to my topic, and I really appreciate when you put questions in between. That makes the lecture a little bit more lively. I'm not just sitting here in front of my computer and keep talking to myself. I can't see you really. The main point I wanted to make with this short excursion into the topic of karma was that the karma of becoming a woman is not at issue here. Now, I want to take up another discourse, just a second please, which directly takes up this topic of giving birth to a female instead of a male. And this is Mallika. Mallika is the wife of King Pasenadi, and he had elevated her from a relatively lowly position in ancient Indian society to become one of his wives. And so she had been pregnant, and then it happened that apparently the king was just visiting the Buddha on one occasion, and then he was giving the notice that Mallika had given birth to a girl. And he had actually very much hoped that she would be giving birth to a boy, could have been a little prince then. And so he apparently must have displayed his discontent at noticing this. And the Buddha, in turn, he replies. So we have here a situation where the text portray the Buddha as directly addressing or replying to this notion that it's like bad luck to have a daughter, and it would have been better to have a son. And so the Buddha is reportedly says, a woman may be better than a man ruler of the people. She may be wise and virtuous, a good wife who reveres her mother in love. Men born from her may be a hero and a king. The son of such fortunate woman may well govern the kingdom. And so we see that here the text shows the Buddha as sort of countering this negative appraisal of the king, and then formulating the positive aspects of having a daughter in terms understandable and acceptable to the king. It's important to understand that this does not mean that in principle a woman is only good for giving birth to sons who can become heroes or perhaps kings, because, I mean, we have a number of bhikkhunis, and the Buddha in the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Etaragavaga, highly praises them for their various qualities. And so the idea is not that women are just good for giving birth to children, but in this situation, the Buddha clearly reacts in a way that does not endorse the appraisal by the king, that it's like bad luck that his wife gives birth to a daughter, but tries to show him a positive aspect of the same. Now I want to turn to a discourse in the Ekotrika Agama that involves a bhikkhuni by the name of Banda Kapilani. And she reports about her own past lives. And so in the, she has been recollecting past lives. This is the same ability that we had just mentioned earlier in relation to the Buddha. The ability to remember where and under what circumstances one has lived in the past, which according to early Buddhist meditation theory is an ability that can be cultivated based on what is called the fourth absorption. Fourth absorption is a very relatively deep state of concentration. And at that point, apparently, the practitioner can start to remember not only what happened in the present life, but also what happened in the past lives. Bara Kapilani had been recollecting her past lives, and then she's been asked to tell about that. And so the first thing she describes is, and a long time ago, she was a very pretty young man walking down the road, and there's another pretty girl coming also down the road, and everybody looks at the girl and nobody looks at the young man. And so the young man doesn't like that at all, and here we have his reflection. None of the people look at me. All of these people together are looking at this woman. I shall now devise a means to make people look at me. So he wants to get even with that pretty girl, and in order to do that, he performs meritorious deeds. He holds a parasol over the Buddha Vipassin. This is the first of seven Buddhas. The earliest concept that we have of this notion of a genealogy of Buddhas. So this Buddha Vipassin is believed to have lived at a very, very long time in the past, far away. And so this young man, who will eventually become Bala Kapilani, stands there and holds a parasol of the Buddha Vipassin for 7 days and then makes an aspiration. May I, endowed with this merit, in a future life have a female body, such that on seeing it there will be no one who will not be thrilled with joy. So here we have an instance where a male undertakes a meritorious deed and then uses that to aspire for female birth. Even though the motivation is a little bit stupid, just wanting to be looked at, wanting to be the center of attention in public. But nevertheless, I think this is, it is remarkable because it's hard to see how such an idea could have come into being in a setting of the type that we looked at the beginning of this lecture, as expressed in that inscription from Thailand or in the commentary literature that we have been looking at. It's the precise opposite. The wish to be female, and this is something that comes about through merit. And Bala Kapilani, in this Ekotarika Agama discourse, keeps on telling about past lives where she aspires and keeps on aspiring to be a woman, to be reborn as a woman. So she goes to, she keeps meeting all these past Buddhas, and so with the Buddha Vesabhu, she offers robes and she aspires, may I have a female body in a future life. And then there's a story with the Pacheka Buddha. It's actually quite an entertaining story there. She is at that time, the former Bala Kapilani is a slave in a household of, and the housewife says, go out and bring somebody here, I want to offer food. And so the servant, she goes out and she meets this Pacheka Buddha, but the Pacheka Buddha is quite ugly. But she doesn't worry, I mean, it's a monk, she brings him in. And so the housewife, she sees the how ugly this person is, and she says, no, I don't want to give him food. And so the servant says, good, then I will give him my, she would get a daily ration of food, I will give him my daily allotment. And so she offers her food to the Pacheka Buddha, and he partakes of that, and then departs and performs miracles. This is usually the way in Buddhist hagiographic literature, how Pacheka Buddhas demonstrate their attainments, that they fly through the air or do kind of miracles. And so when the housewife realizes that this was a very worthy recipient of gifts, she then tries to bribe the servant to transfer the merit to her. And this goes so far that in the end she even beats the servant up. And the whole tale, of course, is very clearly functions within the context. I mean, the Buddhist monastic community, males and females, were dependent on donors. And so we get a very clear message to a donor, then don't underestimate a monastic just because he or she is ugly. It's better to give food because you never know, it might be somebody highly attained. But for my present purpose, the topic what is really of interest is that, again, she is aspiring to be a female after this gift. Endowed with this merit, wherever I am reborn, may I not fall into the three evil destinies, and may I in a future life have a female body of the utmost beauty. And she worships another Buddha by offering golden flowers. Endowed with this merit, wherever I am reborn, may I not fall into the three evil destinies, and may the body I take hereafter be a female body. And she worships the Buddha Kassapa for 7 days, and again may obtain a female body in the future. And she concludes telling her past lives to the other bhikkhunis, saying, sisters, you should know, because of the merits of former events, I became the wife of Pippalimanava, that is, of Mahakassapa. The Venerable Mahakasapa first went forth himself. At a later day, I went forth on my part. So this kind of shows a very different attitude towards rebirth as a woman. She adds, I was recollecting my lives in former days with a female body. For this reason, I smiled to myself just now. I have been covered in ignorance by not knowing that I worshipped 6 Tathagatas, seeking to get a female body. This is the reason I smile, because of my experiences in former days. Now this particular Ekotarika Agamo discourse is quite unique, and the story of Bada Kapilani in the Pali commentary tradition, found in the Pali commentary tradition, is not as strongly formulated as this one. But nevertheless, I think it is significant to find that such stories at all exist in the tradition, and that these show an attitude towards birth as a female that is not only not negative, excuse me, but even present repeated meritorious deeds under a series of different Buddhas, obviously the supreme field of making merit, with the aspiration to be born as a female. And now, summing up a little bit what we have been looking at so far, the basic pattern that I see is that in the early strata of Buddhist canonical literature, the rebirth as a female, rebirth as a male as such, does not receive an explicit evaluation. However, such rebirth taking place within ancient Indian patriarchal society obviously has consequences. And it would be these consequences that eventually lead to associating birth as a woman with as something that one would not aspire to, and therefore relating it to unwholesome karma. But birth as a male, because it in a patriarchal society with its restriction, automatically means that one is in a superior position, then becomes gradually associated with the performance of wholesome deeds. And now, as we see also with this story here in the Ekotarika Agama, from the soteriological perspective of early Buddhist thought, womanhood is not an obstruction for the path. It is an obstruction in terms of ancient inner society, but the gaining of the 4 levels of awakening recognized in early Buddhist thought are not dependent on the sexual nature of one's body. There's in fact not a single passage I'm aware of in the early discourses which would reflect a gendered distinction between men and women in relation to awakening possibilities. And the only passage where women's ability to reach awakening is put into question is in the Samyutta Nikaya and Samyutta Agama Parallel. And this statement is put into the mouth of Mara. Mara is the evil one, the tempter. It's kind of like a figure, a deva of sorts, who often functions as an impersonation of ancient Indian attitudes or problems that monastics may encounter, and in the stories in which he appears, shows then stands in contrast to those who deal with him, who recognize him and chase him away, exemplifying the way how a practitioner, a disciple of the Buddha, should handle such problems or ideas. And in this particular instance, Mara is made to say that a woman is unable to reach liberation because she has only a 2 fingers width. This apparently comes from household chores where women were testing whether the rice is cooked by squeezing it with their fingers. And bhikkhuni to whom he addresses this is an Arahant bhikkhuni Amazona, and she is just dismissing it as ridiculous, and I mean she knows that this is not possible. Tathagata Bhikkhuni, there is the exception of the Kambodja Sutta. Well, the Kambodja Sutta is simply reflecting social conditions, I think. I don't think it is an endorsement. It is not presented as a Buddhist doctrine. It's just saying that in such places, such and such situation exists. So I have discussed these various passages in my book on the foundation history of the Order of Nuns. And as far as I can see, when we take those discourses that are found in more than one tradition together, there is this type of explicit evaluation that it is bad karma to be born as a woman and good karma to be born as a man does not really have much ground to stand on. The question of arahantship leads us on to the question of becoming a bodhisattva. And here I would like to turn to a past life of the Buddha himself as a princess. And before getting into this story, I would like to say a little bit about how I understand the development of Jataka literature. Jatakas seem to start off with stories found in the discourses that apparently or probably at the outset were not necessarily conceived of as actual past lives of the Buddha, but at times were just parables. I've discussed some examples for this type of development in my Genesis of the Bodhisattva. We get, for example, a parable, very clearly a parable involving animals that act in a particular way, and then with the Jataka literature, in particular the prose Jataka, which in the Pali canon belongs to the commentarial strata of literature. The canonical, in quotation marks, canonical part is only the Jataka verse. In the prose Jataka, then one of these is identified with the Buddha. But if we, for a moment, stay with the discourse Jatakas, what is significant here is, first of all, we never get identification with animals. We only get identification with humans. And those stories, still at times comparative perspective, can show that the idea that these were past lives of the Buddha were probably not already there from the outset. There's one in the Kutadanta Sutta where one version says the Buddha was the king, the other version says he was the Purohita, that's the Brahmin chaplain, and very puzzling, the Sanskrit fragment says he was both, which is absolutely impossible, of course. So there's clearly some variations there. But when we look at this first strata of Jataka literature, we find that the Buddha is consistently identified with males. And that is an outcome of the setting of the stories. There are anyway relatively few females in parables and stories populating this type of literature, and they usually also, because simply these stories reflect the hierarchical situation of ancient India, usually females are not in a favorable position. And when we have some parable or story, it would have been natural for the reciters and narrators of the Buddhist tradition to identify the Buddha with somebody who is somewhat exemplary, shows particularly good conduct, or is in a very high position. And so in this first level of Jataka literature, it's just a natural outcome of the narrative setting that the Buddha is invariably considered a male. Now we may come to subsequent developments, particular as reflected in the commentarial Jataka prose of the Pali tradition and similar type of literature in other Buddhist traditions. There we find that quite a number of different stories from various background from ancient India have been brought together. This would definitely be a case that fits what we have been discussing before, what Ravi Chandrakumar had been saying about influence from the general environment. And so when we get all these different stories, and at times animals, and at times even people who, characters who do not behave in exemplary manners are identified as past lives of the Buddha, then I think given the precedent that in the early discourse parables becoming Jatakas, the Buddha is consistently identified as a male, would simply have provided a prototype. A prototype in the sense that maleness would be the one characteristic that can string together otherwise widely different types of personalities. Here an animal, here this high position, low position in society. So maleness could kind of string together all these different lives to make a meaningful account, history of the Buddha. And so I think it is out of this is my hypothesis, that this idea arose that the Buddha in his past life was always a male. And this would also concord with ancient Indian notions that in principle, in passing away and being reborn, there is a certain degree of stability of gender. Let me just see at the questions here. Ravi Chandrakumar, the Buddha speaks about the khandhas as what we accept as the five aggregate and self. The gender equality is a conceptual one which we still fail to comprehend then till now. I'm not sure, Ravi Chandrakumar, if I understand what the five aggregates are or khandhas are. The early Buddhist analysis of subjective experience into those five aspects of this experience that can be clung to, panch upadana khanda. But the point is precisely that these are not self. But I assume self you mean not as atta, but just as who one is, sort of in a more colloquial manner. And gender inequality is a conceptual one, yes, which we still fail to comprehend until now. I don't fully understand, but I assume that what you are intending to say is that the distinction between one sex and the other, and according that to that, a value judgment is a conceptual imposition. Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, she's just giving the references to the two suttas we have been discussing. Thank you. Now, coming back to this topic of the maleness of the Buddha in his past lives, which is particularly strong in the Pali Jataka tradition, actually in other Jataka traditions and other Buddhist schools, this is not as clear-cut. But even in the Pali tradition, in what is a Jataka that is not even part of this commentarial Jataka collection, we have at least one instance where the Buddha was a female. And it is this story to which I wish to turn on. Just a second, please. So the Buddha's past life as a princess. And I want to get started again with this Ekottarika Agama version. So the story is that there's a Buddha in his past life as a princess. And there's a monk, an old monk. And the Buddha at that time has given a talk and said, for those who are not so good at learning meditation, you should still make merits. And so this monk decides, well, I'm old and I'm not so good at meditation, and I'm also not really so good at learning, so let me do something meritorious. And he wants to put lamps up to illuminate the Buddha of that time. And so for doing that, he goes begging in town, and this princess sees him, and he tells her about his intention, and she says, don't worry, I'm going to give you all the utensils that you need for doing this meritorious deed. And so the monk puts up these lamps, and this eventually leads to him being predicted to become a Buddha himself in the future as a result of these meritorious deeds. And so the princess now goes like, wait a moment. I mean, I gave him all the material. What about me? Do I also get a prediction? And she goes to the Buddha, and this is the point at which we get into the story. Then the princess said to the Buddha, I am now the chief donor of the oil that was required, constantly supporting and assisting the monk. Yet the Blessed One has not given a prediction to that monk. Only for me he has not manifested a prediction. So that is the Buddha, or sometimes also called, the Buddha calls himself a Tathagata. So the Tathagata Ratnasiki said, the merit of the arousal of the mind with an aspiration for Buddha is difficult to measure. What to say about the bestowal of a material gift? The passage is a little bit opaque in the original, but I take it to mean that just because she has given the material requisites for this offering, that is not quite sufficient for her to expect that she could be given a prediction. Now she reacts very strongly. The girl Muni, that is the name of the princess, replied, if the Tathagata will not give me a prediction, I shall myself cut off my life faculty. This is a rather drastic statement, and we will come back to this whole issue of feeling negative about having a female body to the extent of even having suicidal intentions with another version that we will look at later. Now the Buddha gives a reply, and the Tathagata Ratnasiki replied, now occupying a woman's body and seeking to be a wheel-turning king, one will never gain it. Seeking to be Shakra, one will also be unable to gain it. Seeking to be the king Brahma, one will also be unable to attain it. Seeking to be the king Mara, one will also be unable to attain it. Seeking to be a Tathagata, one will also be unable to attain it. So in reply to this rather drastic threat or announcement by the princess, the Buddha pulls out what in tradition is called the five impossibilities. The five impossibilities imply that a woman cannot occupy leadership positions in the political or religious realm in the ancient Indian society. So she could not be a universal monarch, a king. She could not be Sakha, which is a king in the heaven of the 33. She could not be Brahma, we explicitly here refer to as a king in another heavenly realm. She could also not be Mara. I already mentioned Mara earlier, which is not a position one would normally aspire to. And she could also not be a Buddha. The issue at stake with these five impossibilities is not about future aspiration, about wanting to become any of these in some future life, but it is about being at present unable to fulfill such a position. And so this reply kind of misses the point, because the princess had not asked to occupy any of these five positions right in her present life. She was only asking to be given a prediction that in a future life she will become a Buddha. So she immediately brings the issue back to what she's actually been talking about, that the girl said, it is certain that I will be unable to attain supreme awakening. And here the Buddha then replies, you will be able, girl Muni, to accomplish supreme and true awakening. Thus, princess, you should know that in the future, after innumerable eons, a Buddha will emerge in the world. He is your good friend from nowadays. That Buddha will give you a prediction. So what this means is that she will be able to become a Buddha in the future. She will also receive a prediction, but that prediction cannot be given to her right now. It will only be given when that old monk who has been making this offering has become a Buddha himself. That is the Buddha Dipankara, which is a wordplay on this making of lambs, giving of lambs offering. And this Dipankara then will give the prediction to the one who is going to become Shakyamuni Buddha. So I just want to briefly look at these five impossibilities. I have studied this doctrine in relation to a discourse called the Bahudhātaka Sutta in Majjhima Nikāya. And this is a discourse on many elements. It works to four main topics. One is elements themselves, sense spheres, dependent arising, and impossibilities. And when we look at this discourse in the light of its parallels, we already can clearly see that topic number one and topic number four have been gradually expanded during transmission. And in the themes that are in common in this topic four, and exposition on possibilities, are these three. One is that there cannot be two wheel-turning kings or Chakravartins or two Tathagatas or Buddhas at the same time. This just means that there can only be one universal monarch. And according to Buddhist doctrine, there can be only one Buddha at a time. And then it is impossible, that is again the topic of karma, that bad conduct leads to a good rebirth or good conduct leads to a bad rebirth. That is not possible. And the third impossibility that is found in all versions is that a stream enterer could commit five heinous crimes. These are like very, very bad actions, like killing one's mother and father or shedding the blood of the Buddha, etc. So this seems to be the nucleus of the exposition of the impossibilities, and the impossibilities for women, these five impossibilities I mentioned earlier, are not mentioned at all in the Madhyama Agama parallel to the Bahudharuka Sutta. And so I have argued in my paper, in my paper on the Bahudharuka Sutta, I have argued that the doctrine of five impossibilities for women is a later addition to the discourse. And quite interestingly, this does not mean that the reciters of the Madhyama Agama were unaware of this doctrine, because it actually occurs in their account of how the Order of Nuns was founded, which is that I mentioned before, the book I have just come out with. So you can find that passage in there. And in the story of how the Order of Nuns got started, this element also seems late. In fact, it's only found in, I think, two or three of the seven versions. It's the Madhyama Agama version, and there's another individual discourse very close to it, and the Mahishasaka Vinaya. And it also comes out of context. So it seems that this idea of the five impossibilities is a doctrine that came into being at a certain point, and different recited traditions incorporated it in different places in their text. And this also holds for the story of the Buddha's past life as a princess, as the idea of the five impossibilities is not found in all versions. And as I said before, it is a little bit out of context. It does not really offer a meaningful reply to the issue of being given a prediction to Buddhahood, making it fairly possible that here too the five impossibilities are a later intrusion. Now, from the Ekottarika Agama discourse, let us turn to the Patipadana Jataka, which is the Pali version. So in this Pali version, we find something very interesting, another thing I have talked about in my recent book, which I would like to call the distancing of women. There's a rather recurrent pattern in Pali literature, canonical and commentarial, of distancing women. Distancing women, I mean, for example, in this particular case, the hero, the princess, is not introduced by name, and she has no direct contact with this historical Buddha. And we have similar things in Pali discourses. One example, Chula Vedala Sutta, where Bhikkhuni by the name of Dhammadina in the Pali version goes to meet the Buddha and talks with him, but in the Pali version she does not meet him. It's somebody else who goes to the Buddha and speaks on her behalf. We have that very strongly in the Nanda Kovada Sutta, and I have that study is there in my new book. And here in the Patipadana Jataka we have the same. The princess is not being given by name, and she has no direct interaction with women, with the Buddha. And so when she is unhappy about having been given a prediction, then it's the monk who offered those lamps, who goes to speak to the Buddha on her behalf. And so then, having heard this complaint, like what was about the princess, the Blessed One said to the elder monk, "It is not possible for me to give a prediction to the princess who stays in the condition of a woman." So this quite explicitly says that somebody who has a female body, because of being a female, because of being a woman, cannot be given a prediction of future Buddhahood. Having heard it, the elder asked the Blessed One again, Venerable Sir, why is it not possible for you now to give a prediction to her being in the condition of a woman? Then the Blessed One said this to the elder, Monk, it is not possible for me now to give a prediction to her being in the condition of a woman because that woman has not fulfilled the combination of 8 conditions for receiving a prediction. So this makes the issue, I think, very clear. Why a woman cannot be an advanced bodhisattva, in the sense of having been given the prediction by some Buddha that one will definitely succeed with the aim of attaining future Buddhahood, from the viewpoint of this particular story. Now we come to another version preserved in the Taisho edition under the number 152. It's part of a collection of stories on the paramis, on the perfections. This one again has the 5 impossibilities. Again, this, and in this case also, before I go into the text, this is the one, she's not a princess. Actually, she's a poor widow. So in this case, the Buddhist pastime is really at the bottom of ancient Indian social hierarchy. Being a widow in ancient India, maybe some of you know this custom of widow burning, where the woman whose husband has passed away joins him on the funeral pyre and lets herself be burned in order to avoid becoming a widow and living in the condition of a widow, which in ancient and even modern India is still a very difficult situation. So anyway, here, exactly, it's known as sati or sute. The Buddha said to the woman, with a female body, one cannot be a Buddha, a Pratyeka Buddha, Brahma, Chakramara, or a wheel-turning king. These dignities are very lofty and cannot be attained with a female body. If it is your wish to attain these, you should relinquish your dirty embodiment and acquire a pure body. This is very, very strong terminology. In fact, as I pointed out in my article, this comes dangerously close to an incitement to suicide, which according to the different Vinaya traditions is actually a parajika offense for a bhikkhuni. If I were to encourage anybody in committing suicide, I would lose my right to be a monk, a bhikkhu. Let's continue with the text. The woman paid respect with her head at the Buddha's feet and said, I shall now relinquish it. She returned to her house and cleaned herself by taking a bath. From afar she bowed down and said, This body is made of the 4 elements. It is anyway not to be kept forever by me. She climbed up a building and formulated the aspiration, May my filthy body now be for the benefit of hungry and thirsty living beings. I seek to become a male myself and receive a prediction of Buddhahood. Whatever living beings in this troubled world who are blind and have turned their back on what is right, who are inclined towards what is wrong and do not know a Buddha, I shall rescue them. And now it comes. She threw herself down from up high. Those who saw it were chilled and shivered. Knowing her intention, the Buddha magically transformed the ground so that it became soft as if receiving her with the celestial net. Her body was visibly unharmed and had been transformed into a male one. The widow became male, became dizzy with infinite joy, quickly approached the Buddha and said full of enthusiasm, Receiving the kindness of the Blessed One, I already gained a pure body. Out of compassion may I receive a prediction. The Buddha expressed his praise. Your courage is extraordinary in the world. You will certainly become a Buddha. Do not harbor any doubt about it. When the one who keeps the lamp burning, Dipankara, has become a Buddha, he will predict your name. Yeah, so this is really drastic. Basically, here the female past life of the Buddha is depicted as being so going so far as to make an attempt to suicide to get rid of this dirty female body. And even though the Buddha praises it and assures of future attainment of Buddhahood, still he doesn't give the proper prediction, which implies which requires that a name is given. Somebody predicted the proper prediction to future Buddhahood. So was in the future time, you will become a Buddha under the name of so-and-so. And so he just says you will get the prediction when the monk who has offered the lamps will become a Buddha. Now we become to a fourth parallel version. This is from the Discourse on the Wise and the Fool, a collection of tales. And this takes a somewhat different attitude to the basic problem of how could a female be given a prediction of Buddhahood. Princess Muni heard that her noble monk friend had been given a prediction of becoming a Buddha. She thought in her mind, "The material for the lamps for the Buddha are all my possessions. Putting them up, the monk has now received a prediction. Only I did not receive one." Having thought this, she approached the Buddha and personally told him what was on her mind. The Buddha in turn gave her a prediction, saying to Muni, "In the future, after 2 incalculable aeons and 91 regular aeons, you will become a Buddha called Shakyamuni, endowed with the 10 epithets." So here the Buddha just gives a prediction and the whole problem quickly solved. The 10 epithets are the standard terms for recollecting the Buddha, describing his various qualities. Then, hearing the Buddha give this prediction, the princess was thrilled within and was transformed into a male who paid respect at the Buddha's feet and requested to become a recluse. The Buddha in turn gave his permission. So here we see that's a very, very simple solution to the supposed problem. The Buddha gives the prediction, and at the moment of giving the prediction, she is so thrilled that she experienced this sex gender change. And in Tibetan and Mongolian parallel, this is based on the Chinese, she even doesn't change sex. She stays a female, and I think the Buddha then would have given her permission to become a nun. So we see with these different stories how different recited traditions operate and try to accommodate the story in common among these different versions, this kind of idea the Buddha had been a princess in the past with the notion that a bodhisattva at a certain point one has to be a male, and so as a female one cannot be given a prediction. And my own take on this story is that the basic plot, because the idea of the Buddha past life as a princess aspiring to Buddhahood, this is not the type of plot that would fall into the pattern of stories taken over from ancient Indian folklore and turned into Jatakas. This is quite a specific Buddhist motive. And I think the basic plot could not have come into being in a setting where the idea was already prevalent that one needs to be a male in order to be an advanced bodhisattva. And my personal understanding of the story is simply that it was originally, the main point originally was about dana, about offering, about the power of making offerings, and it is just the circumstance of the narrative that the one who provides the material for the offering is a female, because that's just the normal experience monks have when they go begging. I mean, I have the same experience when I went begging in Sri Lanka, and the majority of those who give food, who stand outside of the houses and offer food, will be females. So I take it that the main story was basically just on making an offering. And because the one who puts up the lamps, that monk, becomes the Buddha Dipankara, he could obviously no longer then be identified with the Sakyamuni Buddha, and which leaves the female, the donor of the material, to be identified as the Buddha in a past life. And with this basic story coming into existence, then when the issue of malehood, from what I, according to my reconstruction, this movement from the canonical Jatakas to commentarial literature and eventually to the idea that bodhisattva has to be female, comes into being, then different traditions struggle with this basic storyline and find different solutions, if we may say so. Two of them bring in the 5 impossibilities, and the collection on the 6 perfection becomes very drastic. The female becomes a poor widow who even is willing to commit suicide, and the much less drastic solution found here in the discourse on the wise and the fool. It's simply the Buddha gives a prediction, and in the Chinese that leads to a sex change, and in the Tibetan and Mongolian even that does not happen. So you, in the Agamas, the Buddha is usually fair to women. They can attain the target of the path, that is liberation. For what reason in this particular story in the Ekotagama the Buddha is shown as unfair? Does this depend on the different target, becoming a Buddha instead of an Arahant? Yeah, I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I think to think of it as the Buddha being fair or unfair, we have to understand that these all of these stories, including even the Agama discourses, come down in a process of transmission and gradual accretion of material and continuous influence of various ideas from the general social historical environment via the reciters on the text themselves. And so I think it is more helpful to read these different texts as expressions of concerns, notions, and influences of particular time periods, rather than reflecting the actual character of the personalities involved in these stories. And in the case of the Ekotarika Agama, the whole collection is distinctly later than all of the other Agamas and the Pali Nikayas. The collection has very clearly remained open to the addition of later influences and elements to a much greater extent than all of the others. And it has even undergone some change in China itself after the initial translation. So stories from the Ekotarika Agama can fall within a much broader time frame of development than other Agamas and the Pali Nikayas. And I think the Ekotarika Agama version compared to the Patipadana Jataka, which is clearly a relatively late text, and these two Chinese texts preserved in Chinese, we cannot really posit one of them as like the source, the most early version, and the others are later. I think they are better considered as just different executions of the same basic motive. Yeah. Thank you for the question, Soli. So I wanted to just sum up again the main topics that I've been trying to say something about. That is, so the first one was again this whole question of rebirth as a male, and that as far as we are able to ascertain from study of the text and also in relation to inscription, that in the earliest period of the Buddhist tradition, the sexual nature of one's being born was not a central issue, and that became more prominent in later times. The second topic was this somewhat curious idea of change of sex, where the important point I wanted to make is that at the canonical level, a change of sex happening in this life does not meet with evaluation, that only comes in the commentary period. And the third one was the topic of karma, that karma is a central Buddhist doctrine. Again, at the canonical level, we do not get explicit relationship of karma to male or female. We only get the implicit and I think important indication that a certain type of unwholesome deeds leads one to an uninfluential position. And so we could from that reformulate the thing and say it is bad karma to be born a woman if such birth happens in a society where women are being discriminated against. And we could make the same, for example, for the question of racial discrimination, as Monica Zinn in her lecture in the last year's course showed us. In ancient India, having a dark skin was considered beautiful. So I think she showed a picture where that was the harem of the king, and the queen, as the most beautiful, was shown with the most darkest skin. So having dark skin in such a setting would be good karma. but having a dark skin in a place where people with dark skin are being discriminated against would be bad karma. So it would we would no longer have this like absolute normative statements, but not much rather statements that operate within a particular social and cultural context. The fourth topic was on Malika giving birth to a daughter. Excuse me. This kind of story showing us, depicting how the Buddha reacted towards an evaluation of having a daughter as negative in contrast to a son. Then the past lives of Mother Kapilani, where she is shown to be aspiring, doing meritorious deeds, starting off as a male and keeps on aspiring to be reborn as a female. And finally, the Buddha's past life as a princess, where we see the basic plot that the Buddha had been a female in his past lives and met a past Buddha, then goes through these different ways how the traditions are trying to accommodate this narrative motive to the notion that an advanced bodhisattva must be male in order to receive a prediction. Tathaloka. Thanks, Venerable Dhammadinda, for the reference for the Kamboja Sutta. The exceptionality in the Kamboja Sutta is that it unilaterally associates the state of womanhood itself with moral qualities or absence thereof. As an absolute normative statement, Ananda, women are hateful, jealous, miserly, and lack of wisdom. This association stands out as strange and remarkable with regard to the teaching in the Pali text sutras. Yeah, thank you, Venerable Tathagata, but I said I discussed this all in my new book, so you will find all the discussion on that topic there. Is there any other question or comment? We have another 5 minutes. It's pages 140 and 142 that I discussed the Kamboja Sutta. Yeah, so I'm pointing out that there's another Anguttara discourse which points out the exact opposite. That this is also not possible to make this fit with the Anyata Sutta, Anyata rules. But there's quite a lot of discussion on this I have here. And that this is similar to something said in the Manusmriti. Yes, Anguttara Nikaya 497 would be in direct contrast to the Kamboja Sutta. And so this is maybe just another instance of what was the name again? Soliu mentioned before, what I mentioned in reflection to Soliu, that we have to understand these texts as the final product of a longer period of oral transmission, and at times there are ideas from different sources that make their way into this text. Tian Shi Tzu, for what reason a situation of discrimination against women didn't arise in early Buddhism, but it arose later at the time of the early schools of the so-called sectarian period? Are there any difference in the social atmosphere of these two periods? Don't they have the same secular patriarchal society which would explain the discrimination? Well, as far as I can see, the situation for women is gradually becoming worse with the passage of time. So it seems that in the early period, even in the pre-Buddhist period, women still had some limited freedom, but it gradually becomes worse until we come to the time of the Manusmriti, where the situation becomes very bad. So I would personally see this as a development in line with the general historical situation. Ravichandra Kumar, the Buddha expounded to Mahapajapati Gautami on what the true Dhamma is prior to accepting the Bhikkhuni Sutta Chulavaga X5. Yeah, Ravi Chandakumar, I'm not sure what you are intending to say with this. So I simply take it as a comment and thank you. I see somebody's typing, so I wait for that. The discrimination towards female gender is a customary bias, yes. Kimberly Allen, I saw you were typing something. Should I wait for that or? There you go. Do we know anything about the treatment of women in schools that exist simultaneously to the evolving tale about a school but which we don't survive to have full canons? My impression is that the tale about is known to be one of the most conservative schools. Yeah, apart from, well, we don't have full canons of any of the other schools. And even the idea of a full canon is a little problematic, but let us leave that aside. But, I mean, we do have textual material like the Ekotrika Agung we have been looking at now. We are not quite sure, but it could be a Mahasangika tradition. And the Majjhima Agama I mentioned for this absence of the five impossibilities in the version of the Bhagavad Gita is with high probability Salvastivada school. So we have partial material, and there we can see how it is precisely the comparative study of these different transmission lineages which enables us to reconstruct and make informed hypotheses about what is probably early and what is probably later, such as with the case of the five impossibilities or with the discourse that Venmatadaloka mentioned, etc. So I don't think that there is one sort of, I mean, said simply one Buddhist school which is favorable to women and one Buddhist school which is unfavorable to women. But I think this is a general tendency found in pretty much all traditions. And at times we can just find that a particular manner in which it manifests is specific, such as in the Theravada tradition, the tendency to distancing women. Rajiv Chandrakumar, suppressive view that the Buddha did not endorse but was rather caring for the female nun's well-being. Yeah, I think this is something I also cover in my new book, the whole issue about the different attitudes and voices that make themselves heard in the story of the foundation of the Order of Nuns. So I think we have come to the final point now. I see Venmatadaloka is still writing something, but we are about to come to an end. I'll wait for a minute then. All good, all good, all good. All good then. Thank you very much for your attention and participation in this first lecture, and I look forward to meeting you all again, and I'm very keen to see what the other lectures will have to present. And I wanted to mention that this is the last of these courses with on the topic of women in Buddhism, and so next year starting it will be on a quite different topic. I will be taking up the Nibbana Sermons by Venerable Katakuru Nyanananda is also planned to be going on for 3 years. This is a series of talks given by one of the most eminent scholarly monks in Sri Lanka, a scholar and meditator, on the topic of Nibbana. So next year we'll be shifting to quite a different topic, but I hope that still some of you will find this sufficiently interesting to be part of this e-learning venture. Thank you very much.